efficient updating process, which allows the brain to be curious about and absorb the most salient features of the available information. This is, in some sense, the brain's version of our emergency management center, which coordinates communication among agencies that have to respond to disasters. Before I briefly summarize what we have learned about the nature of curiosity from the cognitive and neuroscientific experiments, I would like to mention two more caveats to be aware of. First, in task-based fMRI experiments, the researchers examine the spatial extent, that is, the locations of the brain activity at prescribed times. This is tantamount to assuming that the activity takes the form of a standing wave or stationary wave, such as the one formed in a vibrating violin string held fixed at both ends, where at each point along the wave, the strength of the signal remains constant in time. However, in a study published in June 2015, neuroscientist David Alexander of the University of Leuven in Belgium and his colleagues argued that brain hustle and bustle is more akin to traveling waves, where activation and deactivations move rapidly through the brain. This means that treating the temporal and spatial dimensions as if they are distinct may result in the loss of much of the relevant information. Alexander and his collaborators concluded, "We question the very notion that neurological entities are events that occur at certain locations and times, rather than being comprised of trajectories that extend over locations and times." In other words, this team argues that just as a photograph of a small portion of the sea does not convey the full picture of a turbulent ocean, by examining what happens only at particular regions of the brain at a fixed time, one misses the fact that the activity propagates in a complex fashion throughout the brain. If Alexander and his team are correct, then some of the conclusions from neuroimaging may have to be revised when more sophisticated imaging and data analysis techniques become available. A second qualification is related to the confidence we can have in the results of psychological research in general. In an important collaborative study entitled The Reproducibility Project, Psychology, that was published in August 2015, 270 researchers across 5 continents reported that they were able to replicate only about 40% of the results from 100 studies in cognitive and social psychology that had been published in 2008 in respected scientific journals. This project is part of the application of the scientific method, which advocates continuous testing, rechecking, and questioning the validity of hypotheses. It is only by adopting such rigorous scrutiny procedures that science can be self-correcting. While the Reproducibility Project has been to some extent hoisted with its own petard, a more recent study raised questions about the results of the Reproducibility Project itself, it remains true that we should always exercise caution and emphasize uncertainty when evaluating experimental results in general, especially those that supposedly provide empirical evidence for certain theories favored by the experimenters. Note also that because of technical and funding-related difficulties, studies in neuroscience often involve a relatively small number of subjects. For example, the experiments of Kang and Yepma scanned the brains of only 19 students each. Consequently, the statistical significance of the results is limited. Bearing these important caveats in mind, what is the picture of curiosity that tentatively emerges from all the recent psychological and neuroscientific studies? Here is a very brief overview. Moving into focus. Curiosity has only relatively recently started to receive the focus it deserves. While many of the details of the mechanisms underlying curiosity are still unknown, at least a broad brush understanding is beginning to emerge. What have we learned so far? First, as children engage in increasingly complex activities, they explore their new environments and acquire fresh knowledge. The trajectory that they follow while growing up is remarkably similar for most children, which indicates common underlying mechanisms. Children's curiosity seems to drive them along a path that increases knowledge and involves a well-suited decision process that maximizes learning and facilitates the discovery of causal links. Children seem to understand relatively early that every effect is associated with a cause in an unbroken chain of effects. Their curiosity appears to assign value to competing tasks based on the potential of these tasks to enable discovery. The exploratory behavior of adults also seems to follow rather consistent patterns, even in open-ended circumstances and in spite of individual differences. Artificial intelligence researchers Frederick Kaplan and Pierre-Yves Houdier suggest that all of these elements could be captured in the context of a paradigm in which the goal of curiosity and exploratory behavior is to reduce prediction error to the extent possible. In other words, according to this view, humans, children and adults, avoid both extremely predictable and highly unpredictable exploratory routes in order to focus on those courses to satisfying curiosity that can maximize the rate at which their prediction errors decrease. Gottlieb, Kidd, and Houdier further clarified and expanded what they perceive as curiosity's main goal, which they say is to maximize learning, rather than merely to reduce uncertainty. What is curiosity really? In my humble view, the cognitive and neuroimaging studies appear to support a scenario in which what we refer to as curiosity may actually encompass a family of intertwined states or mechanisms that are powered by distinct circuits in the brain. In particular, the curiosity triggered by novelty, surprise, or puzzling stimuli, perceptual curiosity, seems to be primarily associated with an unpleasant, aversive condition. In this case, curiosity is a means to reduce the negative feeling of deprivation. This type of curiosity is adequately explained by the information gap theory, and its intensity as a function of the level of uncertainty generally follows an inverted U-shape. On the other hand, the curiosity that embodies our love of knowledge and the drive for its acquisition, epistemic curiosity, is experienced as a pleasurable state. In this case, curiosity provides an intrinsic motivation for its own sake. Consistent with this picture of different types of curiosity, perceptual curiosity was found to activate brain regions that are sensitive to conflict, while epistemic curiosity switched on brain areas linked to the anticipation of reward. The satisfaction of curiosity, of any type, is closely related to the neural reward circuit, and it enhances memory and learning, especially when the information violates prior expectations and when the exploration is active and volitional. In the other direction, past rewards can trigger a high level of curiosity, even without reminders or boosting. An interesting recent study suggests that even individual differences can be estimated with some confidence using fMRI. Neuroscientists Ido Tavor and Saad Jababdi of the University of Oxford and their collaborators showed that fMRI imaging of a person's brain while that individual is at rest, doing absolutely nothing, can predict which parts of the brain will be activated during a range of active tasks. Those tasks included reading, which involves language interpretation, and gambling, which is associated with decision-making. As I noted earlier, these new insights do not mean that we now understand curiosity. Curiosity is a topic where ideas jostle each other, and everything can and is likely to change. Here are just a few of the basic questions neuroscientists and psychologists would like to have more complete answers to. Does curiosity play a role in maintaining cognitive abilities during adulthood? What are the precise similarities and differences between curiosity and other basic drives, such as hunger, thirst, and sexual desire? What are the main neural elements and mechanisms that govern and direct curiosity? How exactly does the brain merge those components to construct a clear course of decision-making? What precisely underlies the individual differences in curiosity and exploratory drives? These are not easy questions, and considerably more research is required to provide unambiguous answers to all of them. Concerning the last question, for instance, Gottlieb, Kidd, Udayer, and their collaborators are embarking on an extensive study aimed at testing the interesting hypothesis that an important component of the variations among individuals' curiosity is related to differences in their working memory capacity and executive control. The researchers speculate that since working memory directly affects the encoding and retention of information, it can impact the value we place on learning and novelty. To assess the viability of their conjecture, the researchers will search for correlations between curiosity and measures of working memory in a group of children. They will first determine a ranking of curiosity among the children based on a number of exploratory tasks. Then they will characterize the children's working memory capacity with standard memory tests. These experiments, with more than 100 children, will allow the researchers to statistically examine whether curiosity and working memory are indeed correlated. It is interesting to note in this respect that, as early as the 1960s, psychologist Sarnoff Mednick suggested that creativity, for which curiosity is a necessary ingredient, is merely an expression of an associative memory, the ability to remember the relationship between unrelated items that works exceptionally well. There is another aspect of curiosity that deserves special attention. Humans are different from all other animals in our cognitive ability to formulate and integrate abstract information, in our power to invent and analyze hypothetical and even fictional scenarios, and in our aptitude for turning almost everything we perceive into meaningful why and how questions. Ultimately, it is this curiosity and desire to explore in order to get to the bottom of causes and effects that has led to the birth of religions, to disciplines such as logic, and thereby mathematics and philosophy, and to the quest to understand how nature works, what we refer to today as science, and subsequently to technology and engineering, since most research eventually leads to applications. At the same time, the appearance and evolution of the remarkably intricate human language and the inherent mental power to describe what exists not only in the real world, but also in a world that can only be imagined, have spawned literature, the visual arts, and music. When and why did this marked difference between the curiosity manifested by humans and other animals arise? In the next chapter, I investigate how our ability to ask why is a prerequisite for sophisticated forms of curiosity and is uniquely human. Chapter 7. A Brief Account of the Rise of Human Curiosity. Modern research in psychology and neuroscience suggests that curiosity, at least the epistemic kind, is a mental decision process that aims at maximizing learning. To achieve this goal, it assigns values to competing alternatives based on their perceived potential to answer questions the individual finds intriguing. In essence, therefore, curiosity is really an engine of discovery. The fMRI studies have allowed researchers to locate curiosity in the brain. They have shown that the main regions of the brain that actively participate in the cognitive processes of arousal and satisfaction of curiosity belong either to the cerebral cortex, the outer layer of neural tissue that is the headquarters of memory, thought, and consciousness, as well as motor and sensory functions, or to the striatum, a subcortical part of the forebrain that is pivotal for the reward system. See figure 18 in the accompanying PDF. Consequently, to ask why humans are the only species capable of incessantly asking why is, at some level, equivalent to wondering what makes the human's cerebral cortex and striatum unique among animal species. At the same time, we would also like to understand, from an evolutionary perspective, how those human brain structures became the way they are. Before we begin to answer these questions, however, it may be helpful to review a few simple facts concerning the human brain. Neurons are the core components, the computational building blocks that create brain activity. These electrically excitable cells are the units that process and transmit information through a variety of chemical and electrical signals. As in a vast computer network, each neuron connects with thousands of its neighbors. The connections occur in two kinds of branches, axons, which transmit signals away from the nucleus of the cell, and dendrites, which receive incoming signals. There is a tiny gap, a synapse, where an axon meets a dendrite. When a neuron is activated, the axon secretes chemicals known as neurotransmitters into the synapse. This allows the electric signal to cross the gap and cause another neuron to fire up. As in a fast-moving forest fire, many neurons can thus be nearly simultaneously activated through a chain reaction. The human brain has two hemispheres, which are covered by a deeply wrinkled gray tissue, the cerebral cortex, shown in Figure 18. Each bulging area on the surface is a gyrus, and each infold is a sulcus. The important point for our purposes is that part of the neurons in the cerebral cortex are responsible for everything we associate with the concept of intelligence. Brainy matters. Oddly enough, until about 2007, even though sampling methods based on two-dimensional sections of the brain, stereology, had been extensively used, the total average number of neurons in the human brain, or in the brain of any other species for that matter, was not known with great accuracy. While the number 100 billion was often quoted for the human brain, it was not particularly reliable. Similarly, the number of neurons in any of the brain's substructures was equally uncertain. All of this changed with the admirable work of Brazilian researcher Susana Herculano Uzel and her team. Herculano Uzel devised an ingenious method for counting neurons by simply dissolving the brain into a soup, a suspension of free cell nuclei. Since the soup could be shaken and mixed thoroughly to transform it into a homogeneous solution, counting the neurons in a sample of the liquid and multiplying the number obtained by the approximate ratio of volumes gave Herculano Uzel a fairly accurate determination of the number of neurons in the entire brain, and similarly in any of the brain's components. I first met Herculano Uzel in 2013 and later talked to her in more detail about her work as I was writing this chapter. In one blow, she and her colleagues put an end to years of ambiguity and speculation and replaced them with solid data. So you may impatiently wonder, how many neurons are there in the human brain? Herculano Uzel's answer was unequivocal. On the average, for Brazilian males 50 to 70 years old, about 86 billion. A rat, by comparison, has only about 189 million. That explains why a rat isn't writing this book. And an orangutan has about 30 billion. You may think that 86 billion is sufficiently close to the original estimate of 100 billion, and that, therefore, the added precision is not very important. Herculano Uzel's answer to such comments is to point out that the difference of 14 billion neurons constitutes the entire baboon brain. She and her research team also calculated average numbers of neurons for the human brain's main parts, 69 billion in the cerebellum, the part that is vital for motor control, 16 billion in the cerebral cortex, and slightly fewer than 1 billion in the rest of the brain. Herculano Uzel's work, however, supplied much more information than mere neuron counts. It opened the door to a variety of new insights. In particular, Jon Kaas, a neuroscientist at Vanderbilt University, Herculano Uzel and their collaborators were able for the first time to show that not all brains are built by the same scaling rules. In the brains of rodents, for instance, a 10 times larger number of neurons in the cerebral cortex requires a cerebral cortex that is not 10, but about 50 times larger in mass. In contrast, primates manage to cram more neurons into relatively smaller brains, and also into smaller cerebral cortices. In fact, the brain mass in primates scales roughly linearly with the number of neurons. That is, a doubling in brain mass results in doubling the number of neurons. For example, the brain of the rhesus monkey weighs about 87 grams, which is 11 times heavier than the brain of a marmoset, and the rhesus brain has about 10 times more neurons than the marmoset brain. As primates, humans benefited from this more efficient packing of larger numbers of neurons into a smaller mass in the cerebral cortex and the prefrontal cortex. This neuron jamming has given us humans our first clear evolutionary advantage, at least over non-primate species. In fact, a study by German neurobiologists Gerhard Roth and Ursula Dicke showed that intelligence across species is tightly correlated with the number of neurons in the cerebral cortex. This, however, can't be the whole story. You may still wonder why other primates aren't able to ask, and often answer, why questions. Even more acutely, why aren't they investigating our brains? How do we know that chimpanzees don't ask why? There exists a considerable amount of experimental evidence showing that chimpanzees do not seek explanations for forces or causes that are not directly observable in the way humans do. In an interesting experiment by Daniel Povinelli and Sarah Dunphy-Lely of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, for example, the researchers designed sham wooden blocks that couldn't be made to stably stand up because of small lead weights placed inside. The sham blocks and visually identical functional blocks were presented to both 3 to 5 year old children and chimpanzees. The results were quite stunning. 61% of the children engaged in at least one form of inspection of the bottom of the sham block. Moreover, 50% of the children performed both visual and tactile inspections. Not one of the 7 chimpanzees engaged in any form of inspection. All 7 chimpanzees just kept trying to get the sham block to stand up. They were simply unable to wonder why. A fascinating experiment in 2015 may have identified the specific area of the brain that gives humans their unique ability to process abstract information. A team of researchers led by cognitive neuroscientists Stanislas Dehane and L. Wang looked at the differences in activation in the brains of humans and macaque monkeys as both listened to a few sequences of tones. The sequences differed in 2 respects: the total number of tones, investigating the ability to count, and the arrangement of the tones, indicating an ability to recognize abstract patterns. The team used fMRI to monitor the brains as the string of tones changed. Changes could be of the type AAAB being replaced by AAAAB, where the pattern remains constant but the number changes, or AAAB replaced by AAAA, where the number is constant but the pattern changes. Dehane and his colleagues also examined sequences in which both the number and the pattern changed simultaneously, as in AAAB transforming into AAAAA. In both humans and macaques, the area of the brain normally associated with numbers was activated as the number of tones changed. Both species also registered changes in repeating patterns in the corresponding brain areas. However, only human brains registered an additional intense response in the inferior frontal gyrus, the region associated with learning and language comprehension, when both the number and sequence pattern were changed. The implication is that while the monkeys recognize numbers and patterns, they don't find the abstract combination of the two sufficiently interesting to investigate further. These findings may be relevant to other uniquely human characteristics, such as music appreciation. But why is there such a difference between humans and monkeys? Before exploring this question, I want to investigate another aspect of the human brain that seems rather perplexing, which is related to the brain's energy consumption. The operation of the human brain costs about 20 to 25% of the energy budget of the entire body, in spite of the fact that the mass of the brain is only about 2% of the body's total mass. In comparison, the brains of other species are much cheaper to run. at an average cost that doesn't typically exceed 10%. What is it that makes the human brain's energy bills so excessively high? Herculano Uzel and her team were able to give a clear answer to this question as well. The human brain consumes, relative to the body, more energy simply because it has a much larger number of neurons than the brain of any other primate. As it turns out, the energy consumption per neuron actually varies relatively little, even across different species. The high metabolic cost of the human brain is nothing more than a direct consequence of the fact that it has such a large number of neurons. Our brains, like those of other animals, are a natural product of Darwinian evolution. Human brains are expensive to fuel because they contain more neurons for their volume compared to the brains of non-primates. But this still leaves us with an intriguing question. Why do we have so many neurons while gorillas don't, even though they are primates and they have a much larger body size? Big or smart? Animals in the wild don't have the luxury of going to the nearest supermarket and buying as much food as their credit card allows. Actually, it's a sad reality that many people don't have that luxury either. They have to forage for their meals. There is a limit, however, to how many hours per day they can spend on searching, hunting, chewing, and eating before their health starts to deteriorate, since they also need to sleep, care for their young, and avoid predators. That limit is typically not higher than about 8 to 9 hours. This means that, on average, any given animal, primates included, cannot expect to gain more than a certain amount of energy from food each day. From extensive observations of a number of species in the wild, researchers have concluded that for primates, the daily intake depends on the primate's mass in such a way that a species that is 10 times heavier than another can accumulate and eat, for the same daily duration of foraging, about 3.4 times more calories than the smaller species. At the same time they procure energy, however, the various species also consume energy, both for the operation of their body and for the functioning of the neurons in their brain. And this is where the limit appears. First, it turns out that the rate of physical, bodily energy consumption is a steeper function of body weight than the rate of energy accretion through foraging. Quantitatively, the metabolic cost of the body of a species that is 10 times heavier is about 5.6 times higher, compared to only a 3.4 times higher energy input for the same time spent on foraging. This in itself limits the body size a primate can have when it spends the maximum possible time foraging. Herculano Uzel and her colleagues calculated that top weight to be around 265 pounds, close to the weight of a silverback gorilla that is not an alpha male, not the leader of the pack. The situation becomes even more intriguing when we throw into the mix the additional caloric cost of large numbers of neurons in the brain. In fact, it immediately becomes clear that even if primates spend the maximum time foraging that their physiology allows them to sustain in the long run, about 8 to 9 hours, they cannot afford both a large body and a large number of neurons. As Herculano Uzel puts it, it is brains or brawn. One of those has to come at the expense of the other. To be more specific, researchers estimate that even if primates in the wild were to spend the full 8 hours feeding every day, the maximal number of neurons they would be able to support would be about 53 billion, still far fewer than a human's 86 billion. Even that number, however, would come at the price of the body mass not exceeding about 55 pounds. Trading brain power for body weight, if evolution had allowed for such choices, a primate weighing 165 pounds would flaunt only about 30 billion neurons, about one-third the number in the human brain. Figure 20 in the PDF that accompanies this audiobook shows the brain mass and the total number of neurons for a few mammalian species. This seems to have been roughly the number of neurons boasted about 6 million years ago by the last common ancestor of today's chimpanzees and humans. Then, from about 4.5 million years ago, the number of fossils of hominins was found to increase dramatically. One such discovery became especially famous. The fossil skeleton of a nearly human female dated to be 3.2 million years old. Figure 21 shows a cast from the Muséum National d'Histoire Naturelle, Paris, demonstrated the clear divergence between the human ancestors and the lineage that has led to modern chimpanzees and bonobos. Paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson discovered this skeleton, known as Lucy, in Hadar in northern Ethiopia on November 24, 1974. The name, by the way, was suggested by expedition member Pamela Alderman, who was inspired by the Beatles' song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy's skeleton, as well as a collection of scattered remains of at least 13 other individuals discovered in Hadar in 1975, and a bone found in 2011, are thought to represent members of the hominin species Australopithecus afarensis. From the structure of the foot, the knee, and the spine, paleoanthropologists have concluded that Lucy was about 3.5 feet tall and walked mostly upright. In terms of her diet, she was a vegetarian, who, like modern chimpanzees, ate mainly fruits. If the clear separation of Lucy's Australopithecus, meaning southern ape, genus from the ancestors of some modern great apes, wasn't surprising enough, what came later was absolutely astounding. The brain of the hominin species that has led to modern humans almost tripled in size within the past 1.5 million years. At first, the growth rate was relatively modest. Once Lucy and her kind became habitual upright bipeds, they were able to cover longer distances and to sample a broader variety of environments, since the caloric consumption required to walk on 2 feet is almost 4 times smaller than when moving on feet and knuckles. This reduction in the energy cost, coupled with access to a wider range of foods through gathering, probably allowed for a moderate increase in the number of neurons in a later species known as Homo habilis, the skilled man or handy man, about 2 million years ago. The brain of Homo habilis was already larger than that of modern gorillas. The increase in the number of neurons and in brain capacity started to really pick up speed less than 2 million years ago. It is tempting to speculate that the stupendous upsurge in brain power was intimately intertwined with an accompanying rise in human curiosity. Curiosity is what probably led Homo habilis to the invention of the first tools, sharp-edged stones formed by banging 2 rocks against each other. Once those tools were manufactured, curiosity again helped Homo habilis in recognizing them as a solution to 2 problems Lucy and her cohort couldn't easily resolve. Separating meat from bones and cutting it into more easily digestible pieces and extracting bone marrow from the bones of carcasses. As their own teeth and the skeletal remains of what constituted their meals indicate, members of the Homo habilis species significantly enriched their caloric intake by moving away from strict vegetarianism and incorporating meat as a regular component of their food. The next major step along the way to modern humans dates to about 1.8 million years ago, with the species known as Homo erectus. Members of this long-legged, short-toed species were probably excellent endurance runners, a characteristic that must have helped them in hunting live, although at first small animals, rather than just scavenging cadavers. All of these new improved features contributed, no doubt, to the buildup of the number of neurons in the brains of the Homo species. Natural selection pressure most probably also played a part, since the organization and execution of hunting expeditions must have required enhanced cognitive abilities compared to those needed for the mere digging out of plant roots. The key question still remains, however: what enabled the more than doubling in size of the hominin brain between Homo erectus and Homo sapiens? That phenomenal change occurred within less than 1 million years. As we shall see, it may have been due to something that today we take for granted. Food for thought. The energy limitations imposed on the number of affordable neurons were very real. In order to somehow circumvent those, members of the Homo erectus, and even more so of the archaic Homo heidelbergensis species, had to find a way to significantly magnify the effectiveness of their caloric intake. Fortunately for our ancestors and us, one of the best ways to do that is by cooking. In addition to improved taste, unless the cook happens to be really terrible, cooking permits a much more efficient digestion because it breaks down food into much smaller scales, both on the macroscopic level, by mincing and mashing, and on the molecular level, by heating, thereby exposing it to enzymes in the digestive system. Cooking gelatinizes the matrix of collagen in animal flesh and denatures complex molecules in plants. Furthermore, the advent of cooking added to the human menu an entire series of foods, for instance, cereals and rice, that were previously indigestible. In his 2009 book, Catching Fire, Harvard primatologist Richard Wrangham speculated that the introduction of cooked meat into Homo's diet directly influenced the evolution of the human brain. By examining the rigid energy constraints on the number of neurons, and not just the brain size, Herculano Uzel turned this hunch, according to which we have to thank cooking for the large number of neurons in our brains, into an even more plausible hypothesis. What I find especially fascinating is that if Wrangham's and Herculano Uzel's suggestion is correct, then curiosity may have been instrumental in the rapid rise in the number of neurons through a mechanism of positive feedback amplification. Here is how this scenario might have worked. Curiosity was surely behind the fact that members of the Homo species, probably Homo erectus, discovered that fire could be helpful, and at some point started to use it as part of their way of life. Fire was essential for more than cooking. It provided heat and light and allowed humans to migrate to areas at higher latitudes. The earliest evidence of what appears to be controlled use of fire is about 1.6 million years old, and it comes from two sites in Kenya, Koobifora and Chesawanja. Burned bones and plants that are about a million years old were also found at the Vonderwerk Cave near the edge of the Kalahari Desert in South Africa. Similarly, burned flints and wood found in a hearth-like pattern in Israel date to about 790,000 years ago. The emergence of constant habitual fire use probably came later. Clear signs were found in Tabun Cave in Israel, dating to 350,000 years ago, with similar findings at Schöningen in Germany. In the summer of 2016, archaeologists discovered evidence for the consumption of cooked meat in the Kesem Cave in Israel, a site that is approximately 400,000 years old. Curiosity probably also played a part in the discovery that cooking can soften raw food, make it easier to digest, and make it taste better. Evidence from the shape of the skull dating to this period shows that the facial muscles used for chewing, as well as the teeth, had decreased in size. This is not surprising, given that cooking may have reduced the time spent on chewing from about 5 hours per day to just one. Evolution also led to smaller gastrointestinal organs through an improved diet, in turn saving expensive digestive energy, basically trading guts for brains. All of these changes allowed the Homo lineage to overcome the energy limitations on the number of neurons, eventually yielding a brain doubled in size. Simultaneously, it was probably the enormous increase in the number of neurons in the cerebral cortex, and the less dramatic but still impressive rise in the number of neurons in the striatum, that presumably brought human curiosity to the point where humans gained a qualitative advantage over other primates. Maybe Homo individuals still did not have the ability to start asking the how and why questions, but that capacity was starting to evolve. Once these crucial and seminal questions emerged, perhaps following the inception of human language, as I briefly describe in the next section, there was no stopping humans in their ability to discover and create even more food resources, to establish communities, and eventually to bring the concept of culture into being. All ballooned exponentially. The neuron-rich brain, with its newly elevated curiosity, evolved into an even larger, more intellectually flexible and richer brain. I should note that not all researchers agree with the speculation that cooking played a dominant role in the brain development of Homo erectus or later species. Neurobiologist John Allman of Caltech and paleoanthropologist C. Loring Brace of the University of Michigan, for instance, think that cooking was important only in the past 500,000 years or less, which hypothesis may be supported by the archaeological evidence for the habitual use of fire. Paleoanthropologist Leslie Aiello of the Wennergren Foundation in New York notes that there is no doubt that several converging factors enforced each other through a feedback loop. These could have included a diet rich in meat, shortened guts, cooking, and upright walking. The precise order in which these energy-saving adaptations occurred is still being debated. However, as I said, I do believe that a qualitative change in the nature of curiosity provided an additional crucial ingredient in this stew. A few curiosity revolutions. University of Oxford evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar begins his book Human Evolution with, "The story of human evolution has fascinated us like no other. We seem to have an insatiable curiosity about who we are and where we have come from." Origins have indeed always stimulated curiosity. We strive to understand the origins of our species, of the Earth, and of the universe. The dramatic increase in the number of neurons endowed Homo sapiens with new cognitive capabilities. In particular, it enabled novel mechanisms for information processing, for learning, and for communication. Eventually, our newly acquired mental apparatus led to the emergence of what we identify as the unique human language, probably sometime between 500,000 and 200,000 years ago. Opinions vary as to whether language appeared on the scene through a long, evolutionary, Darwinian-like process, or a rather sudden mutation that instilled the language faculty in the human brain in a phase transition-like fashion, as in water turning into ice. This debate, while truly fascinating in its own right, is largely beyond the scope of our concerns here. As an amusing aside, let me note that the Linguistic Society of Paris banned research on the origin of language in 1866, precisely because it deemed the problem unsolvable by rigorous scientific methods. This ban reflected the challenging reality that, unlike, say, the use of fire, it is virtually impossible to track the development of language by following archaeological relics. I find this 1866 ban amusing because researchers still cannot agree on the theory for the origin of the human language, seemingly confirming the Linguistic Society's prescient fears. From the perspective of the present book, the important point is that it appears quite likely that the emergence of the unique human curiosity and emergence of the distinct human language were strongly correlated. Dunbar suggests that the early purpose of a complex vocal language, as opposed to simple sounds, was none other than gossip. That is, rather than merely conveying very rudimentary information such as "a pack of wolves is approaching," language was used in larger social groups for descriptive narration, addressing issues beyond the imminently existential but still important for survival. As psychologist Elizabeth Spelka put it, "We can use it, language, to combine anything with anything." While there is no consensus on the validity of Dunbar's theory, it hints at an intimate potential connection between curiosity, a key source for gossip, and language. Other theories suggest that language may have evolved for the exchange of different types of social knowledge, such as symbolic social contracts to guarantee the paternity of one's children. Those theories also contain an important curiosity component. The influential linguist Noam Chomsky does not see language primarily as a means of communication. He contends that language evolved and is designed primarily as an instrument of thought. In that respect, it is interesting to note that in 2016, researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, managed to create an atlas of the brain that shows how the meanings of different words are distributed across various regions of the organ. American anthropologist Roy Rappaport, British anthropologist Camilla Power, and others argue that language is only one aspect of something much broader, human symbolic culture. They point out that language works only if a structure of cultural facts has already been established. According to this theory, the appearance of language accompanied some ritual practices. When did those start? The earliest potential evidence for symbolic customs is the use of red ochre pigments in places as the Blombos Cave in South Africa. That ochre processing workshop is about 100,000 years old. The time coincidence between the fossils of modern humans and symbolic artifacts has convinced a few archaeologists, but not all, that modern anatomy and behavior may have co-evolved. Again, the crucial factor from our vantage point is the fact that socially shared myths, rituals, and symbolism were most likely the first sophisticated response to nagging why and how questions and were therefore the fruits of curiosity. The same is true for the conjuring of metaphors and essentially the entire process of abstract thinking, or Chomsky's instrument of thought, that has underpinned the emergence of all culture. The chain reaction that resulted from the positive feedback between curiosity and language turned Homo sapiens into a powerful intellect, with self-awareness and an inner life. The ability for creative thinking, which is largely powered by curiosity, coupled with the aptness to share accumulated knowledge and to pool intelligence with others, eventually led to a few spectacular developments in the history of humankind. One was the so-called First Agricultural Revolution, the transition from hunting and gathering to a diet of cultivated foods produced by settled agriculture. This Neolithic demographic transition started about 12,500 years ago and involved the domestication of various types of plants and of animals such as dogs, cows, and sheep. Another revolution, some 12,000 years later, consisted of the emergence of a dramatically new perspective on the nature of science, the celebrated scientific revolution that started in Europe toward the end of the Renaissance and persisted till the late 18th century. What epitomized the scientific revolution was the transition from the culture of dogmatic assurance that dominated thought during the Middle Ages to the culture of curiosity that put empirical observation and exploration first. Empiricists such as John Locke and David Hume elevated the evidence and impressions of one's own eyes, and encyclopedists such as Denis Diderot attempted to collect all knowledge into coherent texts. The monumental observational and experimental breakthroughs and avalanche of theoretical concepts produced by individuals such as Copernicus, Galileo, Descartes, Bacon, Newton, Vesalius, Harvey, and others came out of the recognition that humans did not know everything, that both the microcosm and the macrocosm had yet to be thoroughly explored. In fact, all the scientific progress that we witness today is a direct extension of these revolutionary ideas. It is not an accident that NASA decided to name the rover that was launched to explore the Martian surface Curiosity. The simple act of listing the names of a few of the trailblazers of the scientific revolution has led me to the next step in my humble attempt to understand curiosity. Since I cannot interview those great thinkers of the past, I decided to briefly interview a few present-day people who are known to be uncommonly curious. The questions that intrigued me in particular were these. How do exceptionally curious individuals describe and explain their own curiosity? How did they choose what to be curious about? Chapter 8. Curious Minds. Einstein once said, "The important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. One cannot help but be in awe when one contemplates the mysteries of eternity, of life, of the marvelous structure of reality. It is enough if one tries merely to comprehend a little of this mystery every day." Some people seem to have followed this advice to the letter. They have been endlessly curious. A few of those people became prominent scientists, writers, engineers, educators, or artists. But most humans are curious, and often it is not about transformative issues, but about the tittle-tattle in their lives. In our age of narrowly focused specialization, the polymath, a person with wide-ranging knowledge and interests, has become an endangered species. Still, people with a burning passion for exploration and investigation do exist. One person who stands out for his curiosity, even among illustrious scientists, is physicist Freeman Dyson. Dyson is credited with having successfully unified different versions of the quantum theory of electromagnetism and light, known as quantum electrodynamics, or QED. One of those versions, by the way, was created by Richard Feynman. Following this remarkable achievement, Cornell University made Dyson a full professor without bothering about the fact that he did not even have a PhD. As important as QED is, however, it doesn't even begin to cover the full sweep of Dyson's accomplishments. During his long career, he has worked on an astonishing array of topics, including mathematics, nuclear reactors that produce medical isotopes for hospitals, the magnetic properties of matter, solid-state physics, spaceships propelled by nuclear bombs, astrophysics, biology, and natural theology. He has also been a regular contributor of essays to the New York Review of Books and wrote a science fiction story at the age of 9. Over the years, I have met Dyson on several occasions and always enjoyed having stimulating conversations with him. In the summer of 2014, I finally got around to asking him about his exceptional curiosity. At the age of 90, he was as sharp as ever. I started with the obvious. Were you always curious? I was always asking questions as a child, Dyson answered, but I did not feel that there was anything unusual about it. This was clearly an understatement. In high school, he had already started to think about problems that would later lead to interesting contributions to the mathematical branch of number theory. And during your adult life, were you interested in certain things more than in others? He thought for a few seconds and then replied, "Mostly I was interested in questions because some friends were working on them. I talked a lot to other people and was intrigued by what they were doing. For instance, I talked to Leslie Orgel, a famous British chemist, about the origin of life, and so I started working on that." But was there any pattern to your curiosity? Dyson reflected again, then explained, "I was definitely more interested in the details than in the big picture, in the animals rather than in the zoo. In your area, for instance," referring to astronomy and astrophysics, "I worked more in astronomy, the study of particular astrophysical objects, than in cosmology, the study of the universe as a whole." "And how did you determine when to move on to a new subject and start a new exploration?" Dyson laughed. "I have a very short attention span. I tend to give up after 2 to 3 weeks. I either solve the problem or altogether leave it." "Wow," I thought to myself, "just like Leonardo." As if reading my mind, Dyson went on to say, "I always thought that being a scientist gives you the license to work on any scientific problem. You have to have the willingness to give up on normal interests in order to look into something else." I continued my previous train of thought and said to myself, "And like Feynman, too." Finally, I asked Dyson whether he had noticed any clear correlation between curiosity and other personality traits. He replied that he hadn't seen any. I suspect that a few of his scientist colleagues might disagree with this last statement, at least when it concerns Dyson himself. Neurologist and author Oliver Sacks, who sadly passed away while I was writing this book, described Dyson as subversive in his scientific creativity. He feels it's rather important not only to be not orthodox, but to be subversive, and he has done that all his life. In fact, Dyson himself wrote in his 2006 anthology of essays, The Scientist as Rebel, We should try to introduce our children to science today as a rebellion against poverty and ugliness and militarism and economic injustice. The second extraordinarily curious person I talked to was astronaut and polymath Story Musgrave. I first met Musgrave in 1993 when a team of astronauts was preparing for the first servicing mission to the Hubble Space Telescope. I was an astrophysicist working with Hubble at the time. As you may recall, shortly after the telescope's launch, NASA discovered to its great dismay that Hubble's primary mirror had been perfectly polished, but to the wrong specifications, a deficit known as spherical aberration. The outer edge of the mirror was ground too flat, not by much, roughly by 1/50th the thickness of a human hair, but that was enough to make the images rather fuzzy. The astronomical community was in a state of shock, and the media were only too happy to latch on to the fact that Hubble rhymes with trouble. Scientists and engineers worked around the clock to develop a plan that would restore Hubble to its originally anticipated performance. Eventually, researchers charted an ambitious scheme to correct the telescope's blurred vision. It was the job of a team of 7 space shuttle astronauts to rendezvous with the telescope and, in the course of 5 amazing spacewalks, to install inside Hubble its eyeglasses, the corrective optics, and a new internally corrected camera. Story Musgrave performed 3 of those jaw-dropping spacewalks. That would have been enough in the category of personal exploration for most people, but not for Musgrave. He has also completed a Bachelor of Science degree in Mathematics and Statistics, an MBA degree in Operations Analysis and Computer Programming, a BA in Chemistry, an MD. He worked part-time as a trauma and emergency room physician, an MS degree in Physiology, Biophysics, and for good measure, he wrapped up a Master's degree in Literature. Oh, and he is also a jet pilot, is interested in photography and industrial design, and has 7 children. I talked to Musgrave again in August 2014 and asked the predictable question, "Why did you study for all of those degrees?" Musgrave did not hesitate. "My curiosity is related to a certain restlessness with not being entirely happy with things the way they are. So I always felt that I need to do something. I always had this energy to explore further." "Okay, but how did you choose these particular topics?" "One thing naturally led to another. I started with mathematics and statistical tools in order to be able to predict for what values of the variables I would get a desirable outcome when dealing with complex systems." He paused for a second. "Those were the early days of computers, so from mathematics I easily gravitated towards programming and operations analysis. Having seen how computers operate, I became curious about how the brain works. This led to studying chemistry, biophysics, and a medical school. Once I acquired some knowledge about the human body and its limitations, the road was paved to the space program." I had to admit that when presented in this way, it all made perfect sense. Still, most of us do not pursue our interests with